Hi, I'm Tracy.
I'm April.
And this is Killer Spirits.
Everyone,
welcome to episode 38,
Velisca, okay. Part two.
Yeah, we're in part two this time, so welcome. I'm glad you're here. We have a lot more stuff to talk about in Velisca, and we also have a really good drink today.
Oh, this drink is amazing.
Yeah, and what did we name it? Haunted Velisca.
The Haunt of Velisca.
Okay, I like yeah. that. Yeah, that's really good. It's really, really beautiful too. It's this beautiful bright green color.
What'd you call it? Ectoplasm?
It looks like ectoplasm. It does. Because we're going to talk a little bit about hauntings today. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good drink for that. And it's refreshing.
It's nice and sweet.
It's sweet, but not overly sweet. Mm-mm. So it has cucumber in it. And I think it just is a really nice summer cocktail, in my opinion. In my opinion. I really like it. So tell us about
Shall I go over the recipe?
Yes.
So... I said last week that I was going to do corn whiskey again. I didn't.
No, we didn't.
Just because.
What's up with the
sigh? Not what I wanted today.
You weren't feeling it.
No, yeah. It's too fucking hot.
Yeah, I feel like corn whiskey is not a hot drink.
Well, it is a hot drink. That's the problem.
Oh, you know what I mean? Not for it being hot.
Yes. So this cocktail has, for two drinks, it has 4 ounces of cucumber vodka. I use the Prairie brand. Mm-hmm. They also make a couple of other interesting vodka, like sort of botanical blends.
Yeah.
But this one's just cucumber.
Yeah.
There's also a Hendrick's gin that you could use that's cucumber. Oh. If you wanted to go gin instead of vodka.
Ooh, that would be good.
Yeah. Probably 5 slices of cucumber.
Yeah.
Muddled in the bottom of a shaker glass.
Aggressively.
You want to get like as much juice as possible. And I would suggest using English cucumber instead of a regular hothouse cucumber because you can muddle the skin and everything. Mm-hmm. If you use a hothouse cucumber, I would peel it.
Yeah. And you could peel it and then muddle.
Bitter. It's bitter if you don't peel it.
Yeah.
But if that's all you have, that's all you have.
Hey, you know, you
I'm not judging do it. You. So you muddle that in the bottom, add the vodka, add 1 egg white. So the white of 1 egg. 1 ounce of Midori, which is Japanese melon liqueur, and 1 ounce of simple syrup. You dry shake it first so it gets nice and frothy. Add your ice. Ice shake it and double strain it into martini glasses. And we garnished with a sprig of basil and a cucumber slice.
It's so beautiful.
And it's kind of hard to even double strain it. So...
It is.
Just be patient.
Just be patient because you're going to have the little chunks that are going to get
in the way.
It's
a lot of pulp.
It's kind of like the drink that I did recently.
The blueberry.
You just got to be a little bit patient.
Yeah, you might have to strain
it
twice.
I mean, you could get like a strainer spoon and take some of the chunks out if you want.
Oh, yeah, probably.
Yeah, that would work. But, you know, it's fine.
Yeah, just as long as it's nice and silky on your finished product.
Yeah, and we did put the edible glitter. Did you say that?
Oh, yeah.
I forgot.
And the green edible glitter.
Yeah. I'm glad it got green. We've been using it.
I said on the video that we shot that it is like stripper glitter because I spilled it last episode and it's all over my dining room table.
It is. I can see it.
So I tried to clean it up again today.
What have you been doing in your dining room?
I just kind of like spread it around. Like it's just kind of like all over the table
it's
now.
It's like in the teeniest, tiniest grooves of the wood.
Oh, yeah. But it does look really pretty in this drink.
It does.
And it's really nice. It lends like that nice artificial ooze color.
It does.
Because the Midori has it. But you don't use as much Midori. So yeah. It could be kind of like watered down a little bit, I think.
So yeah, the glitter sends ectoplasm, it. Hauntings, all of it.
And it's like an ominous foam on the top.
It is ominously foamed.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then I was thinking, because I went out to my garden and just grabbed this basil for the garnish. It would have been really good muddled in with the cucumber. So you could do that too.
You could do that. And I just want everyone to know that I took one for the team. I went outside. I took beautiful pictures and got the biggest splinter of my life in my foot. Oh,
maybe it was out there.
I know it was, because that's when I suddenly came in and was like, ow, what's on my foot?
Yeah, we had to do like minor surgery.
I did. There was needles, people. Involved.
It's actually,
what is it? I didn't look.
It's a dental tool.
Didn't even know that.
It's actually
Please
not.
Don't use that on your teeth.
And what's funny is I know that this goes into feet because I have stepped on it and it went nearly through my foot.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's very needle-ish.
I did fire it, like light it on fire before I put it in your foot.
That's what you were doing.
So it's clean. But this has gone like this far into my foot.
Okay. See what we're doing it. Before we even start this recording.
We're a hot mess by the time we get here.
We are a hot mess. But
literally hot.
The picture is gorgeous.
Oh, the picture is amazing.
So make sure you go to Instagram and check it out.
At Killer Spirits Pod.
Yeah.
So. And I also posted on our stories today, I cleaned the bar.
Yeah, it looks gorgeous.
I like sorted everything because, you know, when we're making drinks, it gets kind of out of hand.
It kind of does. And it's nice to know like, oh, do we have this or do we not have this? And sometimes we forget because we get excited. And
it's like, I have it in my head, but now it's like all dusted. All the glasses are washed. Everything's sparkly and fantastic.
Yes. So I love it. Go check it out. All right. You ready for part two today?
Yeah.
All right. So we're on to Villisca. We talked last week about the Villisca axe murders. And just quickly, I want to say my sources again. I'll talk about them a little bit more throughout today. But Villisca by Roy Marshall. A Nightmare in Villisca, Investigating the Haunted Axe Murder House by Richard Estep. And Murdered in Their Beds by Troy Taylor. All excellent reads.
How long are these books?
Well, like a couple long? Are really no less than 400 pages.
No big deal. No less than 400.
But like I said, the Richard Estep book is a page turner because it's less about it doesn't go as much into the history of the story and more into his experience going into the house with the hauntings.
Gotcha.
So it is a really, really good read, and I couldn't stop reading it.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I read the whole thing probably within a day.
I mean, that's insane. Yeah. I could never, I mean, I'm not dumb.
You're not just dumb.
I just can't read that fast.
Oh, well, no.
I miss stuff.
Yeah, and some people, it just depends on the kind of reader you are. I'm a very fast reader, and I retain a lot, but that's just, I mean,
it's also practice.
It's practice. I mean, I have a master's in English, so that's literally what I did in school.
Yeah.
You just learned techniques. Technique. Okay. You do know that, right?
SpongeBob.
Oh, thank you. Okay.
I watched SpongeBob when I was a kid, too.
I know. Just want to make sure because like I feel like 25 years. I feel like I do SpongeBob references in crowds and people are like, what? And I'm like, again, there's a SpongeBob reference for everything.
There really is. There's so many episodes, it's impossible.
There's so many, and they're still making them. Thank you. Continue to do that. Okay. All right, so as you recall, the Villisca murders were on June 9th, 1912. So let's talk a little bit about some similar murders that took place around that same time. In Colorado Springs, Colorado, on September 17th, 1911, something terrible happened. So Colorado is a resort community that had been founded in 1871 by William Jackson Palmer, who was a Civil War veteran and who had become, he had come to the territory as a surveyor with the Kansas Pacific Railroad.
Oh, okay.
So there's going to be a theme that you're going to see throughout
the
this.
Railroad.
They're all railroad towns. Okay. So, and also, I don't know if you knew this, but tuberculosis patients flocked Colorado Springs because of the mineral waters and the extremely dry climate.
Yeah.
So I didn't really know that.
I think like doctors recommended that.
They did.
They would say like go to, I don't know, it's like high elevation or.
Which makes sense because people who have allergies now, they're like, go to Arizona. You'll never have allergies there.
Seems like if I go to the beach, I don't have allergies.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know why.
Yeah, so that was one of the things that drew people there. Also, there was a bunch of silver and gold that was found around there. So that was another draw for people. So on September 20th, 1911, Nettie Ruth walked to visit her sister, May Alice Burnham. May Alice lived in a home with her husband, Arthur, and their children, Nellie Emma, who was six, and three-year-old John. Nettie and May Alice had made plans to do some sewing together when, like, they had seen each other that previous Sunday. So this is a Wednesday. And they were busy until Wednesday, so they said, hey, let's get together and do some sewing. Because they were behind on their mending, which I thought was very cute because, you know, you didn't have the corner dry cleaner like I have now where I'm like, could you fix my dress? So that was what they did. They mended the clothing. So when Nettie reached the home and tried the door, it was locked, which was actually very unusual. So she tried the back door, which was also locked, and she also noticed that the window blinds were drawn. Also very unusual.
Also very similar to the last story we heard.
Correct. So Nettie went to a neighbor's house, Anna Merritt, thinking that possibly her sister went there because they hung out a lot. But Anna told her she hadn't seen May Alice for multiple days. So Nettie called her brother-in-law, May Alice's husband, Arthur Burnham, who was employed as a laborer at the Modern Woodmen of America Tuberculosis Sanatorium. I always want to say sanitarium. It's not. It's a sanatorium, which was located about 12 miles outside of Colorado Springs. So he was also a patient at the sanatorium and had lived there on and off for years. So he wasn't really home that much. Hmm. Over the summer of 1911, he had gotten much worse as far as tuberculosis. So he'd moved to Colorado Springs to feel better. He started feeling better, and then he started feeling worse. So he was getting sicker and sicker, and between staying at the sanatorium and trying to work his job, he was only home with his family maybe once a week. So Nettie called the sanatorium, spoke with Arthur, who told her he had not been home since the previous Wednesday and had no idea where May might be. Hmm. So Anna had a spare key for the home. She and Nettie went inside, and when they stepped inside, they saw the remains of Sunday's dinner on the table, and Nettie had left that house Sunday evening at 8:45, and it pretty much looked exactly like how she had left it.
Weird.
So she was there. She had dinner with the family, and then she left, and when she opened the door that Wednesday, she's like, that looks exactly how it looked when I left. So a back bedroom contained a bed, which was undisturbed. Nettie and Anna entered the front bedroom and saw the bodies of May Alice, Nellie, and Little John. So, of course, word spread like wildfire, and people showed up in buggies and motorcycles, automobiles, and bicycles, even before the police had time to get there.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. People were right up at the windows, peering in, watching the police and the coroner work. So, you know,
so weird.
You know how people were.
Yeah, creep.
So Elmer Prettyman, the superintendent of detectives at the Pinkerton's Denver office, was working on the case, and he referred to the killer as a quote-unquote moral pervert. So there's no other information or evidence which remains, but it does suggest that the killer did something to Nellie or May Alice.
Okay, so the lady who visited in the first place said that the place looked exactly the same as when she left.
Yeah, it's her sister.
Like, how did she escape unscathed? Like, he waited for her to leave?
Well, probably the perpetrator didn't come until after she left. Hmm. So she probably left at, like, 8:45, and then that person came at, like, midnight or something.
But she hadn't even cleaned up dinner?
No, I mean, I guess she didn't. Huh. We see that in other places, too. Not everyone cleans up dinner before they go to bed, you know.
I mean, yeah, I definitely have those days.
Yeah.
Just seems like back then you'd be worried about, like,
bugs.
Yeah, bugs, rats.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, because, I mean, they were asleep, so they just didn't clean up. According to reports, May Alice and the two children had been sleeping in the bed together when the killer entered the house. All three had been savagely beaten with the flat edge of an axe. May Alice and John had been killed before they could wake up. But Nellie, judging from the position of her body, had woken up during the attack and had tried to escape. The killer had struck her down, and she fell partly across the body of her mother.
Oh.
She's six.
Yeah.
As the crowd gathered, a neighbor of the Burnhams noted something kind of odd and brought it to the attention of the police there. Almost everyone in the area had come out of their homes to see what was going on, except for the Wayne family.
Hmm.
Their cottage was directly behind the Burnham house, and it was silent and dark. Which is always so funny to me. I was thinking this when I was doing this. Everyone's like, oh my gosh, this house has been so quiet. What's wrong with these people? And I'm like, I could be in my house for like 2 months and no one would even notice a thing. Yeah. Because neighbors are very different these right. days. They'd be like, have you seen your neighbor? I'm like, I don't know.
Who's my neighbor?
Who's my neighbor? What do they look like? I mean, I'm not that bad. But yeah, I mean, people just aren't concerned about that kind of stuff. But, you know, of course, back then you got up and you had things to take care of around the house and you had chickens and you had all of these things. And it was odd that everyone else came out to notice this and you're right behind and you're not coming out to see what's mm-hmm. going on. That is kind of odd. So the blinds had also been drawn over the windows and no one was like moving inside the house. Fuck. No one knew much about the Waynes. They had moved into the area about a month before, and the household consisted of Francis Wayne, who went by his middle name Henry, his wife Blanche, and their 18-month-old daughter Lula May, which is the cutest name I've ever heard in my life. So Henry had actually heard about the rental cottage from Arthur Burnham when he was also at the sanatorium. So he had also had tuberculosis. So, you know, they became buddies. Mm-hmm. The Waynes had been living in Indiana when Henry was diagnosed with tuberculosis and was advised to move west to a healthier climate. Wayne rented one of the houses on Harrison Place around the corner from the Burnham's house, and he moved his family from Indiana to join him there. Mm-hmm. So after someone from the crowd was like, yo, why aren't the Waynes out here gawking with us? Police officers decided to investigate, so they went over to take a look. They walked over to the Wayne cottage where earlier a neighbor had actually found an axe that she had loaned to Mrs. Wayne leaning against the house. The axe blade was bloodstained, but that neighbor was like, I didn't think anything of it because I thought they just used it to kill chickens.
Yeah.
Like, I loaned her this axe. It's got blood on it. I just saw it against the wall and took it back.
Yeah.
The police learned later that this was not blood from chickens. Uh-oh. When Assistant Police Chief Springer forced open the door, he found Henry Wayne, his wife, and baby lying in the same bed. 18 months old. That is fucked up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all fucked up, but it just seems extra fucked up to me. It's a baby. So they had, like, May Alice and John Burnham been killed in their sleep.
So this has got to be the same guy.
How could it not?
The right. Well, and this has got to be the same guy as Iowa.
How could it not? I know. This is why we're going to go over a bunch of theories. So they did not believe that robbery was a motive, as there was jewelry still left untouched. The doors of both houses were locked, and the police believed that the killer had exited through a window. Mm-hmm. The rear door of the Wayne house was thought to have been opened by a skeleton key made with twisted wire. Okay. Yeah. Thankfully, our locks are better these days.
Yeah.
But, I mean, not even that they really even locked much. The killer had also opened a screen door, which had been latched by a hook, by cutting the screen. He then locked the door from the inside, killed the Waynes and their daughter, and climbed out a window. Mm. The killer had left the same way out of the Burnham house, but when leaving through the window on the east side of the house, he'd actually knocked over a bottle of ink, which had been sitting on the sill, so he left black fingerprints on the metal bowl that he used to wash his bloody hands.
Ooh.
I don't know if it's going to mean much, but it is... Like,
it's something.
It's something. So on Sunday, September 17th, 1911, May Alice had taken her children to church and was seen at the local store. And then, of course, her sister was over that evening until 8:45. Of course, they did suspect the husband, Arthur, but he did have a solid alibi, and witnesses saw that he was at the sanatorium when the murders happened.
Saved his life.
Yeah. Plus, he was pretty weak and most likely not able to swing an axe like that. Arthur would die less than a year later from TB, which is really sad. And the murderer was never found. A childhood friend of May Alice, by the name of Tony Donatel, was arrested at one point, but the fingerprints did not match, so he was released. Mm. During the early mornings of Monday, September 18th, C. Marshall, a worker at the Golden Cycle Mill, stated that he saw a man acting suspiciously in the vicinity of the Burnham house. Almost 2 hours later, a milkman who was starting his route also saw what sounded like the same man. They both described him as tall and wearing a light-colored hat, but he was never found. So, just some random dude that people saw that they didn't necessarily recognize. So,
which isn't a crime.
Huh?
Which isn't a crime.
It's not a crime to loiter, I guess, though. In some places it's a crime, but yeah. I mean, loiter, it's just such a weird thing. Like, Don't loiter. It's like, what, I can't stand here?
Like, it's a crime to stand here.
I can't stand here. Did you put a sign up? Yeah, it's so weird. I never understood that. Okay, now we're going to go to Monmouth, Illinois.
Okay.
Monmouth, Illinois is a quiet railroad and farming community in the northwest area of the state. And the town was established in 1831. On Sunday, October 1st, 1911, someone entered the home of a man named William E. Dawson, murdering Dawson, his wife, and his daughter in their beds. Their skulls were crushed, their bodies covered with bloody sheets, and there was also something left behind which could possibly connect these murders to the Burnham and Wayne murders in Colorado Springs. So this is October 1st, 1911. The other one was September 17th. Mm-hmm. So
very close.
Just talking a couple weeks here.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. During the early morning hours of October 1st, 1911, William and Charity Dawson and their 12-year-old daughter, Georgia, were murdered in their home near the corner of South 1st Street and East 9th Avenue. October 1st is my birthday. I just want everyone to know. Every time I read it, I'm like, oh my God, it's my birthday. So their small five-room cottage was located in a section of rundown older homes that were owned predominantly by African-Americans. So their home was in like the African-American community. William and Charity Dawson were originally from Indiana and were married on June 6th, 1875. They had 11 children together, three of whom lived with them in Monmouth. And Dawson had moved his family to Monmouth 8 years before after he was released from prison. Hmm. So on the night of the murders, two of the daughters were staying away from home, thankfully. Mm-hmm. One was at the home of a sister in the country, and the other spent the night with a girlfriend from church. And she was also a member of the choir and was actually singing at the church when the bodies of her parents and her sister were found. God. Isn't that awful?
Yeah.
So the only reason I bring up the fact that they were in a predominantly African-American community was because, of course, they were white. And so it was just like a big uproar, like, oh, white people got killed in the African-American community and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. Even though, you know, they could never really prove who did it. We'll go a little bit more into that. Okay. But I think there was a lot of finger pointing at people who definitely were not guilty.
Right.
Just because of that reason.
Yeah. And well, in the time period that yes. It is.
So again, this is a Sunday, which is so weird. Everything's Sunday.
Are they all Sundays?
There's maybe one that's not a Sunday.
Hmm.
But I feel like everything is either like after Sunday, church. After church. This is before, well, I don't know. Yeah, it's a Sunday.
Maybe that's where he finds people.
I know. I just thought that was kind of weird. That like it maybe was always a Sunday.
Goes to the church in town, scopes somebody out, and follows him home.
I don't know. But this was, I think, a Saturday that went into Sunday because on Sunday morning he failed to unlock the church and gotcha. He didn't appear at the 11 a.m. service.
So it's Saturday night then.
Yeah. So Reverend Green became worried. Two men went to the home, and the Dawson house was located several blocks from the railroad tracks in a low income neighborhood. And Georgia's body was found in her bedroom. The bodies of her parents were found in the room next to it. The empty bedroom across the hall belonged to the two daughters that were absent at that time. So all three victims had been beaten to death with some sort of blunt instrument, their skulls crushed. The curtains on all of the windows in the house had been tightly closed, and the bodies of William and Charity had been covered with bedsheets. They appeared to have been killed when they were asleep, but Georgia's body was found in a different position. She was found in the center of the bed with her head shoved down off the pillow and one arm raised above her head. The sheet was tangled in her hand as if she had pulled it up herself. Mm-hmm. I like how I'm doing motions to you. My arm is going up. So had she struggled? Had she been moved? It's unknown.
Mm.
And there were also rumors that she had been raped, but there's no documents to support this. Okay. But it is plausible that something was done to her, mm-hmm. like some of the other victims.
Creep. So, like, at this point, we're dealing with a serial killer.
Possibly, yeah. If you buy into one of those theories that we're going to talk about.
That they're all connected.
Yes. Mm. Then definitely. So police thought initially this was a revenge killing, maybe someone Dawson had been in prison with or like ran with before a prison. Mm-hmm. So unlike at the scene of the Burnham and Wayne murders in Colorado Springs, the murder weapon was not immediately located and was at first believed to have been a hammer or the flat side of an axe. Mm. So they weren't certain. Of course, they called in the bloodhounds. They like to do that. So the dogs followed a trail from the Dawson house to a pond west of town, which was located near the southbound railroad tracks. And on the bank of the pond, they discovered a 2-foot length of 1-inch gas pipe that was covered in blood and hair. And later they determined that the pipe had human blood on it. So
those are good hounds.
Those are good hounds. And that possibly could have been one of the weapons used or the weapon used.
So I know that even as close as recently as the last 25 years, like jurisdictions of law enforcement have had problems with crossover information. And like, because if there's no like national database,
right,
getting that information from neighboring states, it doesn't always cross over,
right?
So I wonder if anybody caught on back then, or if this is like people are piecing it together as new information.
Parts they definitely caught on back then.
Oh, okay.
Most definitely they did. And I think it was a lot to do with the news coverage at the time.
Oh,
the
newspapers. That makes sense.
And so there was a lot of connecting happening.
That's good.
For sure. So several months later, after the murders, a wire fence was removed at the back of the Dawson property, and a pocket flashlight was found where it had apparently been dropped. And the flashlight was taken to the police, and under examination, it was discovered that the words Colorado Springs had been scratched into the metal of the flashlight's case. So this is that piece of evidence they found later that could have connected the two killings.
That's too random for it not to be connected.
It's very random. So it can't be proven that the flashlight belonged to the killer, but it does seem likely, and it is kind of a creepy link between the two cities.
Because it could be
and the two murder scenes.
It could have, the flashlight could have had any city on it.
Exactly. Why Colorado Springs?
Yes.
In 1918, John O. Knight made a confession to the crime, and honestly, who knows why he confessed. Possibly he did so under duress, which is, you know,
not unheard of.
Exactly. Or to shave time off some earlier sentence. I mean, there could be a million reasons why this happened.
Sometimes people are just nuts.
Because he was already in prison. He was, of course, African-American and lived in that community. But there was zero evidence. The only evidence was like, hi, you live near them.
Right.
There was no evidence to actually place him there or anything. Mm. And he was convicted to 19 additional years in prison for this.
Wait, what? For falsely confessing?
Yeah.
Or he was actually charged with the murder?
He was charged with the murder. Yeah. He was charged with the murder. So technically it was like, oh, it's solved, but I don't think it's solved.
No.
Yeah. Not at all.
That's BS.
Ellsworth, Kansas, October 15th, 1911. A couple weeks later.
Kansas. Okay.
About 6 weeks later. There was another set of murders. So Ellsworth was a quiet and peaceful railroad town. Mm-hmm. The town's marshal, Morris Merritt, lived just feet away from the Union Pacific Railroad track. Really close. And he was home one night, and he was certain. He was sitting there, you know, chillaxing, drinking his whiskey. I don't know. I just made that up. But he was drinking something. And he was pretty sure he heard someone trying to enter in one of his windows. And it was on the later side. He was up later than normal. Mm-hmm. So he investigated the noise he heard while carrying his lamp and most likely scared away whoever it was. Mm-hmm. When he got up the next morning, he discovered the screen had been removed.
Oh.
So someone had been fiddling around trying to get in his window.
Yeah.
On Monday, October 16th, again, this is a Sunday night. So Monday, October 16th, 1911, Laura Snook was up doing her regular morning routine and saw her friend's dog in her yard. And her friends, Will and Pauline Showman, lived about 2 blocks up the road. Mm-hmm. So she shooed away the dog and was like, dude, get out my yard. Go home. But at dinner time, she saw the dog again in her yard, which was not normal. So she was like, what the doodle? What's going on with this dog?
Yeah.
So she walked up to the street, to the showman's house, and, you know, was like, these are her friends. So she's like, why is your dog?
Why do you keep letting your dog out?
Flitting around the neighborhood. So in this case, the back door and the screen door were hanging open when she got there.
Oh.
So she actually stuck her head in and called out to them, like, hey, you know, what's going on? Hello. So when she walked in, she found the bodies of the family along with completely blood-splattered walls, which is, all of these have just been, the crime scenes have just been horrific.
Yeah.
It was surmised that the killings took place not long after this attempt to get in Marshall Merritt's window. So I tried, failed, went on to someone else.
And also seems to be getting sloppy, leaving the doors open.
Yeah.
Although I kind of, I'm thinking about what is the point of locking, relocking the doors from the inside and climbing out of a window?
Well, I think we talked about in part one, the thought was that it would delay entry from anyone. Like, no one would just, like, walk in. They'd have to, like, he would hear them. Like, they would knock or if he was still there.
Oh, I see.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't know. It was just a thought.
Yeah.
The murders had been carried out with the flat side of an axe. And as with the past scenes in Colorado Springs and Monmouth, the killer had used a weapon that was found at the scene. In this case, the axe had belonged to the showman's next-door neighbor, Bill Miller. The axe had been embedded in a tree stump in the front yard. And the killer literally took this axe out of the tree stump.
Yikes.
Don't leave axes buried in any tree stumps.
No.
I saw one in your backyard once, April.
Okay, I won't do it.
Yeah, I literally did see one in your backyard.
I mean,
I was like, that looks ominous.
Like that somebody could just pick it up and then axe me with it?
Yes.
I mean, you're not.
They could just creep into your backyard and then, yeah.
Or they could just bring their own axe.
Yeah, but this is like, you know, you just use what's available to you.
A crime of convenience.
That's what I'm trying to think of. Yeah. And you've provided such a convenient weapon.
That's true.
So when the sheriff arrived at the showman house, the axe was discovered leaning against the wall between the front room and the kitchen. It had been washed off with water, but there was sufficient blood on the blade and the handle to show that it had been used for the murders. There was also strands of hair stuck in the blood that matched that of Pauline Showman. The bed had been positioned against the wall of the room. Will had been lying next to the wall and had been killed first. 2-year-old Fenton had been sleeping next to his father and was killed next, which had evidently woken Pauline up. So she attempted to fight off the attack, but was also killed, waking up the other children. So as they tried to get out of their bed, the killer just overtook them and killed them both with the axe. So after the family was dead, the killer completed his whatever ritual bullshit that he does by the light of an oil lamp. So he removed the glass chimney from the lamp, which actually dimmed the light, which kind of explains in the first part when we talked about, you know, because we don't really use oil lamps anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But when you put the glass chimney on, it actually brightens the room more because it, like, reflects the light out.
Oh, okay.
So when you take that chimney off, it's just
a little flame.
It dims the light. So he would have dimmed it, and that's why he did that in all those places. And we'd find the chimney under the bed or wherever else that he found them, or it was found later, because that's what he did. The chimney was later found under a chair in the kitchen. So in the near darkness, he used a bucket of water to wash off his hands and clean the axe, which seems his MO. Mm-hmm. The bucket, still filled with blood-soaked water, blood-tinged water, was found the next day by the investigators. He also took a dress that belonged to Pauline and for some reason draped it over the telephone in the kitchen. Who knows? Maybe he wanted to muffle the sound in case someone called, but why is someone calling in the middle of the night? He does weird shit.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. That's one theory. So, he's finally
not all there.
Yeah. And he did pose Pauline's body in a sexual way. Sheriff Bradshaw wired to Abilene for bloodhounds, of course, which arrived on the 11:57 p.m. train on Monday night. So Sheriff Young of Dickinson County accompanied the dogs, and they were taken to the scene. And the dogs were given a scent from a cloth, which the murderer had dried his hands on. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, busted out, and they followed it to where the Union Pacific and Frisco lines crossed about half a mile west of town. And the crossing was only a short distance from the Showman House. But at that point, the dog stopped and started walking in circles.
You probably hopped on a train.
Absolutely.
Right there.
Yeah, so the trail seemed to end, and the officers believed that the killer walked to the crossing and then boarded a train, just like we said, either a Frisco or a Union Pacific train.
And actually, like, you know, wise of him to do it at a crossing, because who knows which way he went.
Yeah, there's probably a reason these all occurred in railroad towns.
Yes.
So they focused on a man who had checked into the Baker Hotel under the name of John Smith on Monday morning at 1 or 2 a.m., which always is an suspicious odd time. John Smith.
Yeah, you might as well just go with John Doe.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's real John Smiths out there, but it's rare.
I mean, it's just so common that it's rare.
It's so common that it, yeah, it doesn't seem real.
Yeah, it's like a no name.
Yeah. He said he was working in one of the salt mines, or was trying to work in one of the salt mines, so he didn't check out in the morning. And later, a bloody shirt was found in his room. He apparently did go to the salt mine and tried to find work when they followed up on this investigation, but there was no work. Mm-hmm. So he was tracked down a week later, going by the name of John Smitherton. Okay. It's like, okay, who are you? And when authorities found him, he was so drunk, he had to sleep it off in jail.
Oh my gosh, what an idiot.
He apparently got really bad nosebleeds, and that's why he had a bloody shirt. And his wife corroborated this.
As she would.
As she would, but they had no evidence, so they let him go.
Yeah.
They also focused hardcore on someone named Charles Marzik, who was Pauline's brother-in-law. And he went to jail in January of 1906 for stealing wheat. I know you would never find anyone going to jail now for stealing wheat.
No.
I just find that really interesting.
Not in the United States, anyway.
Not in the United States.
Not in a first world country.
No. So he had been married to Pauline's sister, Minnie, and allegedly he blamed their family for putting him in jail. That was the extent of their quote-unquote evidence that he blamed them. Like, no one saw him in Ellsworth. He wasn't near there.
He just didn't like them.
I don't know, but the Colorado Springs Gazette pretty much named him the killer, because how they are. And we're more than happy to pin, like, pretty much all the murders on him at this point.
Let me tell you something. If not liking somebody was motive for murder, I'd be in for questioning a lot.
That's what I mean.
Let's just say.
Yeah. I mean, I blame a lot of people for a lot of things.
Be like, check my text messages, okay? I hate all these people.
Okay, all these people dead now.
Yeah. It was me, for sure.
Yeah. So the Gazette started calling him Billy the Axeman.
Oh, my gosh.
No, they went wild on this. And he was eventually captured in Manitoba, Canada.
He's a wheat thief.
In April 1912. He's a wheat thief, people.
Poor guy.
He's thieving wheat. But he actually had a solid alibi for the time of the murders and had not been in the country when the other murders took place.
Well, that's good.
But he was still brought back to Ellsworth and put on trial for these murders.
Oh, my gosh. For
the Showman murders. So despite the number of witnesses who spoke out against him, none of them actually placed him in Ellsworth at the time of the murders. Like, why? Because he's a convict? You're just
didn't like them.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
No.
And there was even some rumblings of some possible planted evidence in the form of a cigar cutter that he allegedly, I'm using air quotes, left behind in the Showman House. Yeah, so there's a lot more to this story than we know. But he was actually cleared of the crimes and had a not guilty verdict from the jury. But he had to go through all of that. Yeah. And what if the jury had said different?
I always, like, I hate it for the people that have to go through that, who are like, arrested and jailed for something that they're innocent of. And they still, like, lost their job.
Yeah.
Their wife probably divorced them. Their kids moved out. Like, their whole life fucking crumbles.
Even though they were acquitted.
And they're innocent.
Yeah.
And they didn't do anything.
Right.
It just seems wrong.
It's very wrong.
there's almost like really no way around it, but it just is fucked up.
It is very fucked up. So that was October 15th, 1911. Now we're going to go to June 5th, 1912.
Okay.
Which is 4 days before the Villisca murders.
Okay. But pretty spaced out from the last one.
Yes. And there might be a few more like sprinkled in there that we just don't know about.
Oh, yeah.
So Paola, Kansas. This is our Wednesday murder.
Paola.
Paola. The newspapers and detectives actually never linked the murders that occurred in Paola, Kansas, to the crimes that took place in Colorado Springs, Monmouth, Ellsworth, and Villisca.
Okay.
It isn't really until recently that people are like, the Paola murders are most likely connected. That's why I say there's probably more that we don't know.
Right, because they haven't been connected yet.
Yeah, and also remember, the Titanic sunk just a few months earlier in April,
mm-hmm.
and that dominated the newspapers.
Oh, yeah.
So there could have been stuff happening within those couple months that people just don't know about. And Paola was also a railroad town in 1912. So Rollin and Anna Hudson were new to Paola and had only been there a few months after moving from Ohio. People in town said that the Hudsons were visited by a strange pig-faced man who they obviously knew. The Hudsons knew him because they invited him into their house.
Pig-faced
That's
man.
How people described him in newspapers.
Okay.
He was a pig-faced man.
He was probably just a normal-looking dude.
He probably was.
Newspapers always say shit like
that. There was a lot of shit. Like, he was just like, you know, because he was someone that they didn't know, but these were also people who had just moved from out of town. They could have just had a friend come visit. Yeah. So there was evidence in the house later that they had had supper. There was photo albums out. They probably looked at photo albums. And this, you know, unknown pig face man was a suspect for a while. But it's not likely because he never really tried to hide his arrival. I mean, he stayed in a boarding house. People interacted with him. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like he was under cover of darkness or anything. But he was there the night the murders happened.
So maybe like the Colorado Springs one where she had just left.
Yeah.
Dinner.
What, are you going to blame the sister too?
Yeah, now she's right. The suspect.
Exactly. And the neighbors never actually saw him leave the Hudson house, but they did notice that the lights were out by 10, and it was generally believed that he boarded a train and left.
But there's also didn't see anybody enter the house and murder people either.
Exactly. So at 12:01 a.m., June 6th, one of the Hudson's neighbors, Mrs. Longmire, which I don't know if you ever watched the show Longmire, but you totally fucking should because it's really good.
The Western show?
Yeah. I love that show. Anyway, her name is Longmire, and I just wish I was Mrs. Longmire.
And this is midnight?
No, yes. 12:01 a.m., June 6th. Mrs. Longmire was awakened by shattering glass. When she ran into her daughter's room, she found her daughter huddled in a corner of her room crying. And her daughter, so I'm not sure, it didn't say how old her daughter was, but I'm thinking little girl.
Okay.
Like 9 or 10. She told her mother that she had seen a man hovering over her mother's bed.
Oh, God.
Creepy as fuck.
Yeah.
So a few moments later, Miss Longmire heard more breaking glass, ran into the front part of the house, just in time to see a man run out her door.
Oh, God.
So she also found a kimono-style dressing gown draped over one of her chairs, and this dress would later be determined to belong to Anna Hudson.
Oh.
Crazy, right?
Yeah.
And the broken glass she heard was from the chimney of the oil lamp, which he had removed and apparently accidentally dropped. Mm. So he fucked up. And then later that afternoon on June 6th, Rollin and Anna Hudson were found in their home bludgeoned to death. Wow. The murder weapon in this case was never definitively identified. They didn't find it. So maybe an axe, maybe a coal pick, maybe a rock hammer. And that could be another reason it wasn't immediately connected. So all of those reasons. After the killer did the initial blows, he covered them with a sheet and then continued to strike them after. He just ripped the sheet all to shreds. Like, why? 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 The murder weapon was most likely carried with the killer when he attempted to go to the Longmire home, and that could be why it was never found. So all of that, and then he was going to go to another home and continue this. Mm-hmm. And this case was never solved. Police were so focused on what they called Anna Hudson's sordid past, they never looked anywhere else. Oh, so apparently the Hudsons had a volatile marriage. He accused her of infidelity. They split. They got back together. You know, people have this. And that really kind of, I think, overshadowed the investigation.
Okay.
You know? And then 5 days later, Valeska.
Did the little girl, was she ever able to, like, describe what he looked like?
Mm-mm. Just not that I could, not that I could find.
Yeah.
Now, Paola and Valeska are only 3 hours apart via car. I MapQuested that shit.
Oh, okay.
So, not far.
Yeah.
That's an easy train ride. Not far at all. So, on June 10th, 1912, the Moores and the Stillinger girls would be murdered. Mm-hmm. So, that's not a very far distance. So, let's talk a little bit about theories. Mm-hmm. So those were some of the murders that were really in the news and connected at the time. Possibly connected.
Right.
So, theory number one of Valeska. And you remember Frank Jones of Valeska? I'm your senator.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you recall, Joe, he was Joe Moore's boss until Joe kind of struck out on his own and they became competitors. And we did talk a bit about that motive in part one, which, I mean, it's flimsy at best. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a terrible fucking motive.
Just because you, like, don't like somebody doesn't mean.
Like, we're competitors. People compete all the time.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go axe your family, okay? No. However, there's more to this story because Frank Jones's son, Albert Jones, had been married to a woman by the name of Donna Bentley for 2 years. Their house, Donna and Albert, was the first one north of the alley from the Moore's house. Very, very close.
Hmm.
Now, Albert was older than Donna. Not much of a looker, apparently. Not very smart.
But his dad was rich?
But he was from money.
Okay.
Donna, on the other hand, was younger, and she was considered exceptionally beautiful. Oh, so okay. I don't know if you remember the whole Gibson girl thing, but there was this time period of, like, the Gibson girl was, like, all women wanted to look like the Gibson girl. And she was this, you know, drawing that had been done by an artist on a magazine. I don't know the whole story. People are probably like, oh, my God, oh, I didn't know the whole story. But I know at that time period, that was like, you know, people want to look like famous people now or mm-hmm. a certain way. Well, she looked a lot like that.
Oh, okay.
And I did find a picture of her. I'll try to post it. She was stunning. Like, she had beautiful dark hair. It was, like, piled all up on her head in a bun. And she had a high neck.
She was trying to get some
collar. And yeah, I mean, she was beautiful.
Yeah.
And people were kind of like, why are these two together? You know,
maybe she was trying to get into politics.
Right. So the night of the church festivities, Albert and Donna were sitting on their front porch and they were too tired to attend and decided to stay home.
Mm.
After the murders and possibly even before, there was a rumor spreading through town that Joe Moore and Donna Jones were having a secret affair.
The dad?
The dad.
Okay.
So Donna already had kind of a rep for being unconventional, let's say. I probably like would that. Have liked her. I know.
I'm going to use that more often. You know, you're just a little bit unconventional.
Unconventional. So even during the courtship with Albert, she would, like, sneak away and be alone with him. I guess she worked as, like, a governess or a teacher in someone's home. That was, like, a very naughty. Like, women would not do that mm-hmm. back then. So, she was kind of a flirt, too. There were actually many men who were accused of having an affair with Donna.
Hmm.
And you have to wonder, was this the case because she was a bit ahead of her time and beautiful? I mean.
Or maybe they were lying.
Yeah, I mean, the way society views women is ridiculous even now. So I kind of take most of this with a grain of salt. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe she just was a little bit more extroverted and, you know, who knows? And you're not going to blame a woman back then for marrying someone for money. Like, what else is she going to do?
Right.
That's literally her job is to find someone to marry.
Yeah.
So, who knows? But this rumor did not bode well for Frank Jones, who already had been portrayed as a possible murderer. So there's this other link. And then, of course, what about Albert? Could he have done this out of jealousy, which seems so unlikely because why wouldn't you just go kill everyone?
Or maybe if he's dumb, be convinced to do it?
Possibly. There's, yeah. So that's.
Or like coerced,
there's no definitive proof of anything.
Okay.
That was even going on between these two, but, you know, who knows? So that's one theory, that mm-hmm. also kind of, you know, was a reason for why Frank Jones would have had Joe Moore and his family murdered. Theory number two. Remember in part one, when we had our reverend who was in the back of the church, Reverend Lynn George Jacqueline Kelly. Such a name, huh? Mm-hmm. So he was visiting the reverend from out of town. He was sitting in the church the night of the murders, and he stayed.
Oh, yeah, the out-of-town guy.
Yeah, he was staying with Reverend Ewing and his wife, who slept outside in a tent.
Yeah, what the hell?
So Reverend Kelly was what people would consider a pervert. He was a big, fat perv. Mm. He would, like, look in windows, trying to, like, watch young girls and shit. What? And he's a reverend. This guy had no problem getting reverend jobs, which I don't understand at all.
I don't understand how people got away with that stuff. I don't understand how people get away with it now.
You're right. And he was like a twitchy little red-haired man with a gaunt face and deep blue, like blue deep-set eyes. And he was originally from England. I think he came over to America when he was 26. And people described him as peculiar and maybe even like cuckoo bananas.
Okay.
Yeah. He was a little bit out of his mind. So after the murders, Kelly talked incessantly about the crimes. Like more than just I'm curious about what happened, more like I'm a creep. Mm-hmm. And then he starts inserting himself into the investigation. Like, guys, I saw a strange man at the train depot. But wait, there's more. I think I actually saw that same guy in church that night. Isn't that wild? Yeah.
So he's like making shit up.
Oh, I'm sure. Yes. Yeah. He told people he was a criminologist.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, he's cuckoo bananas.
He's definitely cuckoo bananas.
Now I understand better why he was sleeping in a tent outside.
Well, he wasn't.
Oh, his wife was.
No, the other reverend and his wife were sleeping outside.
Oh, shit.
He was sleeping
inside.
So this
is the local reverend?
No.
Oh, my God.
Is this confusing?
Wait, so the guy came from out of town.
The guy came from out of town.
He sleeps in the guy's house and makes him and his wife sleep in a tent outside.
He didn't make them.
But they did.
They chose to because, remember, she had, like, respiratory issues.
Okay, fine. I was just thinking that the people who live in the house would probably sleep in the house, but I guess not.
No, because remember I was saying it's probably muggy in June and freaking Iowa. And so they're like, I can't sleep in this place and I need freshness.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what happened. And, you know, remember all the detectives that they got from all over the place? There was Detective Toby and Detective O'Leary. Well, they dealt with Kelly very differently. Toby was like, dude, you are a nutcase. Get out of this investigation. Goodbye.
Good.
But O'Leary was like, hey, bro, let's chat. Like, maybe you actually know something.
Like, maybe you're going to slip up and tell us something.
Maybe you're the murderer.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Maybe you're going to be a little bit too interested.
Yeah. So Kelly's wife would later provide personal information, verifying that he had deviant sexual tendencies. Mm. And there is a picture. Okay. He was like a tiny little guy. He weighed like 120 pounds. Yeah, and he was really short. And she is like this really tall, they're a very odd coupling, these two. Yeah, so she provided that information. And there was also a claim that he had taken a bloody shirt to the laundry at one point after the murders. He was looking like a good suspect. With Reverend Ewing and his wife in a tent, he could have snuck out of the house with no one hearing. They wouldn't have known. However, many of the investigators agreed that he was unstable and odd, but harmless, which I don't like the word harmless because I don't think anyone's harmless. And they like to use that word a lot. Oh, he's harmless. No, I just don't. I don't know.
I wonder if he was even like fit or like strong enough to axe murder a whole family.
Exactly. That's one of the things that's going to come up. So, yeah, they said he was harmless, but he's also an idiot because during the summer of 1914, he was actually arrested in South Dakota, charged with using the U.S. mail to try and entice a teenage girl to pose nude for him as inspiration for a religious book that he was writing.
Oh, my God. Get fucked, dude.
Yeah. So, get like, this here. Was the earlier versions of trying to get someone to send you a nude text.
I hate people like that.
Like, what the hell?
Sick fuck. Yeah, so, that's like the old timey.
It's the old timey
like Snapchat.
Yes. So anyway, he was caught for that. He was later transferred to a federal mental asylum in Washington, D.C. for evaluation.
That's probably a good place for him.
Yeah. And while he was there, he started acting uber wacky, which only like shone the light on him harder, where people were like, He started speaking about the murders in Villisca constantly. to both inmates and guards, and even implied that he was responsible.
Okay.
He groped other inmates and made attempts to sexually assault them, which doesn't sound too out of the norm for jail, but I don't know.
Well, and also doesn't seem like you're tiny.
Yeah.
Like, don't.
Exactly. Well, that's why it never worked, because people were just like, swat him like a fly or something.
Get out of here.
Yeah, they're like, no, it's not happening. He ranted, he begged to be killed, and he also attempted suicide.
Okay.
When he was interviewed in jail, he denied he was involved, though. So he was released after a few months when doctors said again, he's harmless.
Okay. Yeah, he's just this attention-seeking behavior.
Yeah, and this is perfect because he loved the newspaper coverage of him. Like, all the newspaper coverage that they talked about him being the possible killer, he loved it. And it wasn't long before he was being looked at by the grand jury, and he was actually indicted for the murders.
What?
Yes. So even as the trial approached, the theory that Frank Jones was truly the murderer, though, or more likely he hired the murderer, was still big news. And
hired, I could understand.
And Kelly was just a fall guy. So there's two very distinct camps here happening.
I guess the thing that I don't understand about Kelly is, like, at what point are you working? Like, you're doing all this extra shit.
And you're still getting jobs, dude?
Yeah, you're, like, traveling all over the place.
Preaching the word of the Lord while you're trying to get girls to pose nude for you?
Yeah, what? I don't know.
He was a deviant.
What a freak. And his wife's just like, oh, I guess I'll go with you.
Yeah, I don't know. I hope I can get that picture posted because it's, like, in the book, so I need to figure out how I can extract it. Yeah.
You can probably just, like, take a picture of it.
That's true. It was just, when you look at it, you're like, this is the weirdest pairing that ever happened. Before the trial for Kelly was to begin, Attorney General Havner, who had his eye on running for governor, decided it would look very good for him, especially if he was able to get a true confession from Kelly. So preparations were made at the jail, and the questioning of Kelly began at 10:30 p.m. at night and continued through the night. In attendance was a court reporter, attorneys, oddly enough, not Kelly's attorney, Sheriff Myers, and a special investigator named James Risden. And the whole session was taken down in shorthand because, you know, they're not recording anything back then. Mm-hmm. Kelly read it, he made corrections to it, and he signed it.
What?
Yeah, he did.
Fucking freak.
In late summer 1917, the trial began. Now, the court pretty much thought that this confession was laughable because Kelly admitted shit all the time and made up shit all the time. They're like, this means really nothing. Also, the defense stated the confession came after Kelly had been, quote-unquote, abused for hours and hours. So, I mean, you're in there with him all night. You have not his attorney in there, which is very odd. Mm-hmm. And Havner was shady as fuck anyway. He would later be tried for suppressing a witness when he allegedly asked her to change her testimony. Mm. He refuted these charges, though.
Of course.
But Attorney General Havner, we don't know. You seem a little shady shade.
Yeah.
And back to what you were saying, Kelly was short and he weighed only 120 pounds. The defense argued it was so unlikely that Kelly could have raised the axe high enough to make the marks on the ceiling that we talked about.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even think about that.
I mean, they gouged out the ceiling. Way. You're going to have to be so tall, but also so strong, I think. So closing arguments lasted 2 days. It was a hung jury. The defense thought the prosecution wouldn't bother with a retrial, but guess what? They did.
Oh, my gosh.
And the retrial was set for late November.
How stupid. What a waste of time.
Oh, my God. Two trials for
this
guy.
When you could actually be finding the real killer, and this is what you're focused on.
I know. On Saturday, November 24th, after less than 5 hours deliberation, he was actually acquitted, even with that confession.
Yeah. I mean, that would be like telling me that a 13-year-old girl did it. It's like, really?
Yeah. Isn't that funny, though?
Yeah. Was he on stilts?
So, anyway, that's the second theory, that Kelly is, some people believe that he's still the murderer.
No.
Some people believe Frank Jones was the murderer. Theory number three. Mm-hmm. All of these murders were committed by a random drifter. A transient butcher who hopped trains and went from place to place murdering random victims.
That seems the most plausible to me.
So a true serial killer of the early 1900s. Yes. Even though they didn't have that term back then. So there's actually a book by Bill James called The Man from the Train that digs way deep into this theory. And they actually even identify a person who they feel is the serial killer by the name of Paul Mueller, or possibly Miller. It's uncertain. Hmm. Whom he believes to be responsible for most of these murders. So Paul Mueller was an immigrant, possibly from Germany, who was the subject of an unsuccessful year-long manhunt as the sole suspect in the 1897 murder of a family in the West Brookfield, Massachusetts. They had employed him as a farmhand. So there's that theory. In 1912, Billy the Axeman was identified as a few people.
Yeah.
So, again, they were connecting the dots here, but they didn't have enough evidence to do anything. Mm-hmm. He was identified as an escaped lunatic by the name of Galasco Onchevy. I don't know if I'm saying that right. He'd actually killed a former school teacher named Jenny Claghorn. Her beheaded body was found on the street.
Yikes.
And he confessed to the murder. They thought, well, maybe this is the guy. He was a possibility, but it was never proven if he had done the other murders. Another possibility was Henry Lee Moore, who was no relation to the Moores, mm-hmm. who murdered his mother and grandmother in their beds with an axe in December 1912.
That could be something.
Possibly.
Because it wouldn't make sense that all the murders, like all the incidents, are so similar.
I know.
And then for all of a sudden him to like behead somebody in the leave their body in the street.
I know, that doesn't seem, that seems like it's, he's just too, like, that was a crime of passion or something.
But it's like, it seemed like he did the same things every time.
He did.
The blinds were closed, sheets pulled up over the bodies, the axe, the smashed heads, the weird other stuff.
I agree. I totally agree.
Yeah.
Are you ready to segue? And you can marinate on your theories. We're going to segue into some hauntings now.
Oh, yeah. Well, because this is never solved, so all we have is theories.
Yeah, and that's really, you're absolutely true or right or whatever the hell I'm trying to say. Yeah, you are right. And honestly, I don't feel it'll ever be solved because it was too long ago. There's no evidence left.
No.
But we can talk about. And none of those
people are even alive.
We can talk about theories. You can marinate on those theories, think about what you want, and go read the books for real because you're going to get just mountains of information and that'll inform your theory even more. So the house on lot 410 in Villisca had been built in 1868 by George Loomis. It was purchased by Joe Moore in 1903. Now, after the massacre, the house remained the property of the estate until 1915 when it was purchased by J.H. Giesman. Over the course of the next 90 years, the house had 7 different owners, including the Villisca State Savings and Loan, whose name appears on the title from 1963 to 1971. In 1971, the house was sold to Kendrick and Vance, a plumbing and heating company, and a month later it was sold again to Darwin Kendrick. He remained as owner, renting the house out to tenants until it was sold to Rick and Vicki Sprague, on January 1st, 1994. A few months later, a real estate agent approached local farmers named Darwin and Martha Lynn about the possibility of them purchasing the house. So they're like, yeah, let's do it. So they took the plunge, and they actually started renovations utilizing old photographs to make the house look exactly the same as it did in 1912.
That's cool.
So they really, I mean, they jumped in with both feet. Mm-hmm. Because the house had been added all this plumbing and all, I mean, yeah. It changed a lot over the years. And honestly, if they hadn't bought it, it probably would have been just bulldozed.
Yeah, built something else.
Yeah. An outhouse and a chicken coop were added to the backyard. And a small barn, like the one that housed the Moore's horses and cows, was moved onto the property. Because their original barn had been torn down ages before. The Lynns referred to testimony and records from the coroner's inquest and grand jury hearings to place furniture inside the house where it had been at the time of the murders.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So you can now take tours, even stay overnight, which is what...
stay overnight.
People do.
Ugh.
Which is what Richard Estep did, and he writes about in his book. Mm-hmm. He actually did multiple times, and he writes about it. A Nightmare in Villisca. So he and other investigators have captured many EVPs, which are electronic voice phenomena. Mm-hmm. in the house. So a child singing, a female voice saying, I'm coming in. One saying, that bastard. Some of these happening when literally no one is in the house.
Oh, so they like left.
They leave the house and they have cameras. So motion sensitive cameras that were not tripped, but the EVPs picked up sounds like this. So I actually listened to a few, creepy as fuck. You can listen to some of these online. I don't recommend doing it at work. So I'm listening to it. Someone comes up behind me. Scares me to death.
Oh my gosh.
I'm like, why am I listening to this right now?
We could probably play them.
We probably could play them, and maybe we will. Let's do it.
Wait until the end of this episode and we'll play them.
Yeah, we're going to play them for you. They are really creepy. So there's actually an episode of Ghost Adventures you can watch too, which...
His hair. I know you're going to say it.
I'm not going to say anything about his hair. I mean, okay, we can talk about that. The hair is interesting, but they do have a flair for the dramatic.
They do. Very dramatic.
However, the episode was really interesting and I enjoyed watching it. And they also capture some pretty creepy stuff. So they interviewed two sisters who lived there in the 70s, I believe. And, you know, they're older. I want to say they're in like their early 50s or so. They were young when they lived there. And I didn't even write this down because I'm just going to like talk fluidly They interview these sisters, and one of the sisters is so overwhelmed, like, she can't even stay in the house. Like, she can barely breathe. She's got to go outside. Like, they're just very triggered. They had so many different experiences there. They would hear voices. They're, like, they're super traumatized. They did not like living there. And they were young children, like 10 and 8 and stuff like that.
So their parents were probably like, get over it, dude.
That is exactly what happened, because she would tell her mom, like, I hear a child talking. And her mom's like, dude, just go to bed.
Yeah.
So one of the sisters was talking about how one time her father, actually it happened a couple times, her father liked to, you know, when you sharpen knives and you would kind of do it towards you when you're sharpening. Well, all of a sudden he felt something move his hand and he stabbed himself.
Ooh.
Yeah. And that happened a couple of times where it was just some unknown force like caused him to do that, which was odd because he sharpened knives all the time, never had any problems, but he's in the kitchen and this happens.
Weird.
Watch the episode. It's really good. She'll tell you. It's better in her own words. It's her experience, not mine. Also, one of the hosts, Zach, the hair one, he also runs around the house with, like, maybe the actual axe that did the killings. He procured it from, like, the town museum.
Okay, I don't know if all that's necessary, but all right.
Yeah, I said it's a little dramatic. I mean, they have, like, silhouettes, like, hacking into a bed and stuff. You know, I mean, it's a thing, but... In the children's bedroom upstairs, Zach tells the house to, like, show us your power, you know? And then the closet door, like, gently swings open. Now, this particular closet door does have a history of opening and closing itself for many who visit the house. In his book, Murdered in Their Beds, which I have used a lot in this episode, author Troy Taylor talks about his own experience in the children's bedroom while visiting the home with some ghost enthusiasts. And he is not of that. He is more of like a historian. So he has his own experiences and he does believe that this happened. He actually inspected the closet door in detail. He looked for open windows to rule out any drafts as well as any slants in the floor. Like, he's like, I want to see why this closet be doing its thing. Okay. And as one of the enthusiasts there with Troy, he was offering candy to one of the children. Remember Paul? He said, we'll give you candy if you close the closet door. Okay. That's so crazy. The door opened itself and then closed itself right after that was said. That's right in front of so Troy's spooky. Face. That's yes, so spooky. It's very spooky. Also during Ghost Adventures, the crew went into the barn, which even though this is not the original barn, people have said that it does contain a lot of paranormal activity in there. The crew captures an EVP in the barn that says, I killed 6 kids, which is completely accurate. While they are in the barn, no one is in the house, and the remote camera is activated, it records the sound of three distinct footsteps walking on the hardwood floor, and then the attic door slams violently shut. Not even a strong wind could shut the attic door like that. The door is wide open and flush with the wall, and it swings 180 degrees to close itself. And this happened a split second after that last footstep is heard.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And Richard Estep said in his book that when he spent multiple nights in this house, there is nary a breeze. It is just like, there's no air conditioning. Mm-mm. There's nothing. So it is just super silent and still. There's no way that could have happened. Spooky. On Friday, November 7th, 2014, a 37-year-old man was treated by first responders at the Villisca Axe murder house for a single stab wound to the chest.
What?
A stab wound that, by his own admission, was self-inflicted.
Okay.
Okay, remember the sharpening of the knives incident? Yes. So the incident took place in the downstairs bedroom at approximately 12:30, which some people kind of said that was the approximate time of the Villisca Axe murders. Mm-hmm. The police officers that responded to the scene pretty much ruled out anyone else entering the house and doing this. Mm-hmm. There was no outsider. I mean, the guy even said, I did it myself. So the house had been rented for the night by this person's parents, mm-hmm. like as a gift. Like, this is your birthday gift.
Oh.
Okay, this is fine. This is an awesome gift, guys. But just don't stay there by yourself. He was completely alone in the house at the time of the stabbing and would later state that he had done his best to recreate the crime scene inside the property, presumably in an attempt to stimulate paranormal activity into taking place. He did survive his injuries after being flown by helicopter to a regional trauma center in Omaha, Nebraska.
Wow, is that bad?
It was very bad. In 2019, a show called Kindred Spirits interviewed him. And they called him Buck. I don't know if that's his real name, but that's what they called him. Buck stated that after trying to recreate the crime scene, he saw a huge orb hovering above him, and then the knife, it was impaled into his shoulder. It penetrated all the way through his lung.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
From, like, this angle?
Yeah.
Like a down angle?
Like, I think it went, like...
Oh, like...
Like front ways.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, like the front part of your shoulder.
Gotcha.
And then it, like, went into your lung. So there are numerous instances on record of people experiencing strange physical symptoms inside the house. Unexplained nausea, headaches, and generalized weakness are three of the most common people report. Some people believe there is pure evil in this house. Either the murderer, which doesn't really make sense to me because he didn't die there.
Yeah.
I mean, he just went along his merry way. But some people have said, it's the murderer. And I'm like, well, that's kind of odd, but... Or evil spirits attracted to the home because of the residual energy from the massacre.
Okay.
I've heard that too.
I didn't know that was a thing, but sure.
I didn't really know either, but it can be, apparently. There is believed to be a trickster in the house who claims to be one of the children, but really isn't.
Hmm.
So some people think the children are there. A lot of people say it's just a trickster spirit acting like the children.
Okay.
So the author... of Murdered in Their Beds, Troy Taylor, believes that the Villisca murders were done by a serial killer who is also responsible for the other murders. So theory number three, he's fully in that.
Mm-hmm.
He does not believe there's enough evidence, however, to identify who it is. He also believes that the uneaten sandwich that we talked about in part one, remember we said he made a sandwich but never ate it?
Yeah.
So his theory about that is that the killer didn't know the Stillinger girls were there, killed the Moores, went downstairs, made a fucking sandwich, heard a noise, then went to kill the Stillinger girls.
Interesting.
It's an interesting theory. And then by that time, it got late. He didn't eat a sandwich. Mm-hmm. It's also a possibility that it wasn't the killer who rearranged Lena Stillinger's body and conducted the bacon act.
What?
There is a theory... I know, and this is weird, that it was Reverend Kelly.
Oh, God.
That he was out window peeping and came across the scene after the murders and went inside.
What a fucking...
Because he knew a great deal about the crime scene. Possibly because he actually saw it, right? But didn't do the murders. Mm. It's an interesting theory. I mean, that's all very random, but I don't know.
It seems of his character.
It does seem of his character. But anyway, I encourage all of you to read the books and be the judge of yourselves. Read it and find out. I mean, at the end of the day, 8 people were murdered in that house, 6 of them children. It's an enduring tragedy, and it's incredibly heartbreaking. The victims were loved and cherished, and people did grieve for them. So if you visit the Villisca Axe Murder House, which I definitely want to, don't forget that and tread lightly with respect. I know I will. But that is the story of the Villisca Axe Murders.
Whoa.
That is a lot.
That is a lot.
You know I couldn't do that part one.
I know. No, there's no way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot.
Especially and even, gaining into all the other murders.
I mean, I could do a whole episode on just the hauntings. Because there's so, so much.
Let's play the hauntings.
Okay, get ready, guys. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Hello. Hello. Okay, so we're going to play some EVPs for you. And these are from the American Association of Paranormal Investigators, which was founded by Stephen Wiedner of Denver, Colorado, in August of 2002. And the premise of them is to develop a more scientific and organized method of collecting, analyzing, and presenting data from the investigations. So you can actually go check out their website. It is Ghost Pie, but Ghost Pie, like pie without the E.
P-I.
I'm trying to say, yeah. So ghostpi.com, and you can listen to their Villisca recordings and a bunch of others they've done.
Cool. So this is a 4-minute video of a bunch of the EVPs they picked up.
Yeah.
I'm only going to play a couple. This one says, we often like to set up equipment, then lock and leave a location for a couple of hours while we go get dinner. This is one of those recordings. 45 minutes after we left the house and with no evidence of anyone entering the house on any of the several recorders left running, we captured a very long EVP of a child talking. Only one recorder picked it up. Also, the volume level is boosted, which attributes to the background hiss.
Right.
Okay, that is so loud and so obviously a child.
It is so obviously a child.
Some of the other ones I skipped through because it's like...
Play another one.
Okay, hold on. Let me find another good one.
Yeah.
Okay, so this one says, this EVP was caught by a recorder placed at the top of the stairs. The only people in the house were Stephen, Jill, and Eric down in the kitchen area. And you can tell we are in another room by the distance of our voices. So you hear them laughing like in the other room. Mm-hmm. And then... it says, Jill was telling a funny story and we all laugh in the other room, but there's another female laugh that's captured on the recorder much closer to the microphone.
Creepy.
It's creepy. And they play it over and over again, so you'll be able to catch it.
That is so creepy.
They like slow it down for you so you can hear it better. That's so weird.
I don't like it.
Okay, I'm officially exhausted from this story.
Sorry. Well, hey, we gave you some evidence.
Oh, man.
Some EVP action.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, it is creepy.
That's what our upgraded equipment. We can just Bluetooth into the thing. Wait,
dudes, listen to us.
I'm going to be playing audios all the time now.
We're going to be audioing.
Audioing you all the time.
To death.
Go check us out.
Yes.
On Instagram at Killer Spirits Pod. Shoot us an email if you'd like to say hi.
We're at killerspiritspod@gmail.com. We're on TikTok at killerspiritspod. You can check out our Etsy shop. I put some new thermal mugs up there.
Oh, yeah.
They're really cute. What else? Go check out our drinks on Instagram.
Yeah, go check them out. And also rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Absolutely.
We'd love to hear from you.
We love you guys.
Bye.
Bye.